This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's smuggling, and then there's smuggling. We're going to talk about nuclear smuggling, the illicit trade in nuclear technology. It's the most underappreciated and terrifying facet of global nuclear proliferation, according to my guest David Albright. This nuclear underground is one reason why it's so difficult to detect or prevent the construction of secret nuclear facilities. The smuggling is driven by profits. Big money for the countries, companies, and criminal networks that deal in proliferation. Albright says if there wasn't a profit motive, countries like Pakistan and North Korea would have real trouble acquiring nuclear weapons. Albright is the author of the new book Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. He's the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, which focuses on stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. It investigates and monitors nuclear proliferation. David Albright, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's talk about the story of Syria's nuclear program, because that's a very revealing case study. And also, your group discovered the location of the nuclear program, which Israel bombed.
That's right.
So remind us about the story about the Israeli attack on what they assumed was a nuclear reactor.
The attack on the Syrian reactor was a big surprise publicly. All that we saw initially was that something militarily had happened inside Syria. Israel denied they'd done anything. Syria tried to trivialize it. The United States wouldn't say anything. And so it was a big mystery. And so the only thing that really happened over the several weeks was ambiguous leaks occurred that over time pointed to that a nuclear site had been hit inside Syria. But Syria, of course, was denying that. In fact, denies it to this day that it was a nuclear site. My own group got very curious about what was hit. I mean, we were hearing stories. It's biological weapons site, chemical weapons site, missile site, nuclear. And we decided to try to find out using commercial satellite imagery. And so we got a lot of imagery of Syria and started to look and also started to interview people in the media and governments and eventually came across a site near the river, Euphrates River, that looked like a nuclear reactor that North Korea would have built. And when we published that, it was the only evidence that of an actual site that had been attacked. And then we were, after publication, we were able to get an image that showed the place had been flattened and there had been the damage from the bombing. And then the Assyrians had come in and just kind of cleared everything off and scraped the earth. And so it's fairly dramatic confirmation that this was the right place. Governments, for various reasons, did not want to talk about this.
Yeah, why not? And I mean, Israel was so proud when it bombed the reactor, the nuclear facility near Baghdad. So why
right.
in 2007 did it not want to take credit for bombing what was a nuclear facility in Syria?
I think what emerged when I talked to Israeli officials and U.S. officials was, so long as Syria didn't say anything, they didn't see anything to be gained by kind of making it public and in a sense admitting that they've attacked a nuclear site. They worried about sort of the general Arab reaction that could occur, that if they really admitted to it, then there could be quite a bit of condemnation by various Arab governments. But if no one was admitting anything happened, then that condemnation really couldn't take place. One of the things that happened after Israel bombed the Osirik reactor in 1981
the one in Iraq.
Was, uh-huh. in Iraq, was that there was universal condemnation. The Israelis were members of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and there was an effort, a successful effort launched to throw them out for attacking another country's nuclear facilities. And the United States had to so defend Israel that it ended up as a threat that it carried out, in fact, withdrew from the International Atomic Energy Agency for a year or two. And can you imagine, with all everything going on with Iran, North Korea, Syria, if the United States withdrew from the International Atomic Energy Agency now? So there are forums where this could have played out very negatively. And so I think the United States and Israel breathed a sigh of relief that Syria was willing to keep it quiet. And they knew the facility was gone. And Syria can't build reactors. It depends on imports of reactor components. So they could also say, look, this problem's been dealt with for X number of years. And if Syria wants to keep it quiet, all the better. We don't have to deal with the political repercussions.
No, one of the really interesting things about the Syria story is the connection to North Korea. You said that your group, the Institute for Science and International Security, was able to say this is probably a nuclear reactor because it looked like the kind of nuclear facility that North Korea would build.
That's
so
right.
What's the North Korea connection to the Syria nuclear program?
Well, when we looked at the imagery overhead, the building looked fairly nondescript. And we learned later that Syria had gone to tremendous taken tremendous steps to try to disguise the facility so it wouldn't look like a North Korean reactor. But when you naively measure the dimensions from overhead, and you end up with dimensions that are very close to a North Korean reactor that's at the Yongbyon site, and you end up concluding that despite all this camouflaging, that it sort of looks like this North Korean reactor.
So what did North Korea supply to Syria? And how much money do you think North Korea got for it?
Yeah, there are a lot of questions that remain, and one of which is what Syria paid and exactly what Syria got. I mean, the evidence seems to suggest that Syria got reactor technology. They got some engineering support, and they got some reactor components. They must have gotten some uranium to fuel the reactor. Syria also utilize North Korean trading companies to buy things in Europe for the reactor. And so you had North Korea both providing things directly and then organizing in collaboration with the Syrians kind of smuggling of reactor components or equipment to the site. But it's probably one of the biggest mysteries right now is, did North Korea provide uranium? And there's some media reports which depend on intelligence information that suggests that there was a certain amount of uranium sent to Syria from North Korea, but it's still unconfirmed, and the Syrians refused to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency, so the inspectors are more or less stuck.
So this Syrian facility that was bombed by Israel in 2007, that was designed to be a nuclear reactor that could be used for generating uranium for nuclear weapons?
The reactor was designed so that it could use uranium fuel to make plutonium.
Right,
and then the plutonium could be used in nuclear weapons.
Got it. I've never designed a weapon myself, so it gets a little confusing. Now, you write in your new book that as a source of proliferation, North Korea has nearly matched the AQCON network. That's pretty amazing. I mean, how much do you think North Korea has exported in terms of supplies that are needed for renegade nuclear facilities?
Well, with Syria, it's pretty extensive, the program or the supply was stopped. I think North Korea intended to go all the way, probably with Syria, and that whatever Syria wanted, they probably would have either provided directly or helped Syria get. With other countries, it's less clear. I mean, we know North Korea provides missile assistance to many countries, Syria, Iran. Did it in the past with Egypt. There are suspicions that North Korean may be helping Burma acquire some nuclear items. I mean, we know they're cooperating on military items, but there's also concern that they may have crossed over into some nuclear areas. And the problem is North Korea likes money, and it doesn't demand very much of its customers. I mean, it demands secrecy and large payments, and it's willing to do a lot for that.
So North Korea poses two kinds of nuclear threats to us. One is their own nuclear capacity, which is what now? And the other is their ability to export to other nuclear wannabes. So what do you know about North Korea's nuclear capacity now?
North Korea has a small nuclear arsenal. It's tested twice underground, so it has more confidence that its nuclear weapons will work. Its program is largely based on plutonium that it got out of a reactor at the Yongbyon nuclear site north of Pyongyang. It appears to be able to put a warhead on a ballistic missile. All these things probably don't work that well, but nonetheless, they probably work well enough. North Korea has also been restarted or accelerated a program to enrich uranium using gas centrifuges. And those that centrifuge assistance to get the program going originally came from Pakistan and AQ Khan, but then it's essentially been on its own. I think that in recent times they've accelerated their centrifuge program, and that would probably mean they want to get the other nuclear explosive material, highly enriched uranium. And you just have to wonder what they want with that. But typically when countries go that route of having both plutonium and highly enriched uranium, it's to build more sophisticated weapons, including up to thermonuclear weapons. So North Korea seems determined to continuously expand its nuclear weapons capabilities and its nuclear arsenal. Now, at the same time, it likes to sell things. And as the Syria case demonstrates, it's willing to sell nuclear facilities. And so you have to worry that it's going to be selling centrifuges.
Now, you write a lot about AQ Khan in your book, who, again, is the father of Pakistan's bomb and the leading, until he was arrested, the leading smuggler of nuclear materials. And you say that AQ Khan declined to help al-Qaeda, that he was approached three times by al-Qaeda. Why didn't the AQ Khan network work with al-Qaeda? I'm glad they didn't, but why didn't they?
Well, I think they had their own limits. I mean, in members of the network, would surprise you if you met them. I mean, in the United States, we kind of call some of them country club people. I mean, they were respectable businessmen in Europe, South Africa, Dubai. Khan is, you know, is very learned, and I think they were horrified that al-Qaeda could get nuclear weapons. And so there were just lines that they weren't willing to cross.
Is that in part because AQ Khan is Pakistani and maybe not sympathetic to al-Qaeda's cause?
Well, it's hard to know his motives. I mean, but he's not a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's most popular among kind of the right-wing fundamentalist part of the Pakistani public, but he's not a fundamentalist. And so I don't think he would normally warm up to al-Qaeda, Taliban. He wouldn't want his children to have been – he has two daughters. He's not going to want them put under the controls of groups like the Taliban. So I just don't think he's that drawn to those kind of people. And I think he understands, too, that you know there's lines that if he crosses – I mean, he knows that he's risking his life. I mean, and if you're not ideologically motivated to help the Taliban – and al-Qaeda, then why would you want to take that kind of risk? I mean, no amount of money is worth ending up dead.
So, you know, we're talking about Khan in the present tense, but he's not active as a smuggler anymore, is he?
Not as far as anyone knows. He's essentially a free man. And what you have to worry about is that he's helping intellectually. I mean,
how?
Well, through passing information that's on CDs or... he uses to communicate with journalists. He does it through his wife's email account. And so I think that kind of communication is easily monitored. But if you have a courier carrying something, a trusted courier, then it starts to get harder to monitor if he's not under house arrest or under close surveillance. And I think the restrictions on him have gone down. He's certainly mad. He's mounted almost a media campaign to try to you know, what he calls clearing his name, but it's – and so he is active in engaging people internationally. And so you have to worry that he could be thinking about helping some others.
You describe Libya as the pinnacle of the AQ Khan network's achievements.
Yeah, Libya was the pinnacle of the AQ Khan network's achievements. I mean, it involved – $100-200 million. It was a country willing to buy whole facilities. Was open to help on making the nuclear weapon itself. It was tolerating pretty slow deliveries of the key items, and had very deep pockets, and had no incentive to reveal anything at the time.
Now, Libya, on the other hand, is the only country that abandoned a nuclear program. Why did Libya abandon its nuclear program? And this is what, in 2003?
Three, that's right. And I think there are many reasons. One is the sanctions were taking a toll on Libya, that Gaddafi didn't want to take anymore. I mean, and he was also starting to solve this issue over the bombing of this Pan Am plane over Lockerbie, Scotland. It resulted in so many deaths. And so he... he was starting to resolve that internationally. And I think he was willing to slow down the program. Now, what was important was it's not clear he would have ended it if something else hadn't happened. And that was the busting up of the Khan network by the CIA and MI6.
And that made it harder for Libya to get what it needed?
Well, what happened is the busting up was so thorough that they gained such incredible evidence that it, in a sense, 100% ironclad evidence that Libya had this secret nuclear weapons program underway with the help of Khan, that they had to admit to it. They couldn't get out of admitting to it. And since they were interested in reducing sanctions internationally, they both basically had to go all the way and give it up. And so it was one of these cases where the CIA and MI6 launched a very successful operation. It took many years, but the operation was so successful that it helped convince Libya to completely give up nuclear weapons, which we saw by how the International Atomic Energy Agency was allowed to come and do a thorough set of inspections to scrub all this out.
Since Eurogroup monitors nuclear proliferation, and Libya is one of the few countries that actually abandoned its nuclear program, what lesson do you take away from the Libya story?
Well, one is that you can convince countries to give up nuclear weapons. In that sense, sanctions can have a very important role in convincing countries to give up nuclear weapons, as can intelligence operations that are directed at disrupting nuclear weapons efforts. It also shows how important inspections are, that the inspections can either reveal a program after the fact, unfortunately, in the case of Libya, but the weakness of the inspections that were in Libya refused to let the IA do its job, can also send an alarm to the international community that maybe something's going on here and increase suspicions that something secret with nuclear weapons is going on.
You tell a great story in your book about this family, a father and two sons, the Tinners, who are from Switzerland and were part of the AQ Khan network, and then they became informants for the CIA. So tell us, first of all, what they did for the network.
Friedrich Tinner was at the beginning of the Khan smuggling network. He worked with Khan in the 70s and was very important in Khan getting the wherewithal to make nuclear weapons in Pakistan. And he was interested in additional business, and so he was anxious and interested in this offer with Libya that evolved in the 1990s. And he became responsible for making the centrifuge components for the deal. And he enlisted his two sons to help, and so they launched a major effort to find ways to make centrifuge components. They would contract with, for example, a company in Switzerland to make, let's say, 30 components. They were setting up established a company in Malaysia to make another dozen or so components. And they were looking to set up workshops other places to be able to make centrifuge components. And so they were working internationally to find the ways to put together what amount to about 1 million components. And they were running into some trouble, but overall they were succeeding. And we call them the three Tinners. It's the father, Friedrich, and then two sons, Urs and Marco.
So how did the three Tinners become CIA informants?
Well, as far as I could determine, I mean, the main way was through Urs. He had some trouble with the law. And
this is one of the sons.
That's right. And he'd been sent to Dubai to take over Tinner operations there. Dubai was a major hub for the Khan network, and it had no export laws. And so kind of all this activity was legal. And so they didn't have to worry about police shutting him down. And so he was initially contacted by the CIA and kind of convinced to be what I would view as a reluctant source for things. I don't think he was a CIA operative at that point, but it allowed the CIA to start to see what was going on and to figure out what the Khan network was up to with regard to Libya. It's at some point in 2002, 2003, the CIA and MI6 convinced the three Tinners, the father and the two sons, to participate. The Tinners were visited In June of 2003, one of them, Marco, the son, was kind of pressed to turn over a lot of information to the CIA at his home, including computer files. June of 03 is the date when the Tinners kind of, in essence, went on the CIA payroll. I obtained some documents in 2005 that showed that the Tinners actually sold the CIA quite a few of the centrifuge components they were making.
Sold the CIA?
That's right. It sold it.
After they became informants or before?
That's right. So this was after June of 03. And that makes sense from the CIA's point of view, is buy up what you can. Keep it out of the hands of Libya. And so it made a lot of sense to buy it up. But what was clever is the Tinners got the same amount of money from the CIA, according to this shipping document, as they were charging the Khan network. I mean, the CIA didn't get any discount on the centrifuge parts. And it was Tinners were collecting for this set about $1 million for the sale. The Tinners were also providing information about the network. And Urs was tasked... He was in Malaysia at that point. He was tasked to find out the date of a crucial shipment of centrifuge parts that were bound for Libya. In essence, it would be the smoking gun of this whole effort if it could be seized. And so Urs provided the shipping, did get the shipping documents. It terrified him to do this, but he did get the shipping document or the shipping information and was able to alert the CIA about the departure of the shipment. And then the CIA was able to track the shipment and then finally seize the goods that were on the ship. It was called the BBC China. And that became a smoking gun. And at that point, Libya could no longer deny what was going on. And that helped turn them to say, look, then really we do have something and we're going to give it up.
I'm not going to be surprised if the Three Tinners become the subject of a movie.
Well, that's right. But, you know, they're like mafia informers. And they broke a lot of Swiss laws. And they're subject to prosecution in Switzerland. And that's...
Well, actually, don't you write that they ended up serving more time than anybody else in the AQCon network?
That's right. Because as soon as they were arrested, they said, look, we work for the CIA. The CIA certainly wasn't saying that very openly. And it started sending signals to the Swiss government. Yeah, these guys had done some good things. But what happened, unfortunately, was the Swiss prosecutors said, look, you broke some pretty serious laws here. And yes, maybe you did some good, although we can't get the U.S. to really tell us much about that. But you broke these laws and you're accountable for those. Please cooperate with us so we can understand what you did. And the Tinners took the position of total non-cooperation with the Swiss prosecutors. And so the Swiss government the Swiss court system was under a bind. They could flee with the help of the CIA. They're not cooperating. And so they decided to keep him in jail. And yes, they ended up, the two brothers served probably more time than anyone else. The father was released after about 6 months for health reasons.
And the son served, what, 5 years, was it?
3 and 4 years.
Okay. I want to talk with you about Iran, not only because they're probably very close to nuclear weapons now, but also because you played a role in uncovering their nuclear program. So let's start with that. What was your group's role in uncovering what Iran was up to?
In 2001, we learned Iran had secret nuclear sites. I mean, we didn't know where they were. But an Iranian opposition group in August of 2002 revealed that there were two secret nuclear sites near various two cities, Natanz and Iraq. And what that allowed us to do is start to buy commercial satellite imagery and start to try to find those sites. And after an investigation, we found them. And what we were mystified by was one near the town of Natanz. The opposition group had called it a fuel fabrication plant, which wasn't very credible to us because we knew Iran had had such a plant elsewhere. And that's not a very sensitive facility if you're thinking of nuclear weapons. And so what we were able to do was figure out that this site was a gas centrifuge plant. And so we were able to release, in conjunction with CNN, this pretty dramatic story that Iran was building this gas centrifuge plant. Now, the International Atomic Energy Agency and intelligence agencies knew this already, but the public didn't know. And More importantly, Iran, because it wasn't in the public domain, was continuing to deny that it had such a facility. And so our revelation forced Iran's hand to publicly reveal its gas centrifuge program.
Now, you're right. You were very surprised by the Bush administration's reaction to the public disclosure of Iran's nuclear program.
Yeah, I was surprised and disappointed. I mean, they appeared so confident that, in a sense, the military option would work, that their reaction to us was, look, when we get to Baghdad, we're turning right. That's right. Instead of thinking, well, how do you work this thing diplomatically when you've got to start to get Iran in a corner? How do you get concessions from them? Regardless of any military plans, you have to have a policy and a plan to deal with Iran. And if they're at a disadvantage, you want to be ready to take advantage of that.
During the Bush administration, Seymour Hersh wrote several articles about how the Bush administration was considering attacking Iran. And I'm wondering, how close do you think the Bush administration ever got to actually following through on that threat to turn right after Baghdad and attack Iran because of its nuclear program?
I never thought they got very close. I mean, if things had gone differently in Iraq, I think they may have gotten very close and maybe even tried something. But I think the military lost the appetite. I mean, the policymakers didn't lose the appetite to make threats, but you didn't see much behind those threats, and Iran didn't seem to see much behind those threats, and actually got emboldened. Plus, it used those threats to rally its nation. It could use it as for propaganda value to say what the United States is intending to do, and you better stick with us and support the nuclear program, which is the right of every Iranian. And so I thought it was used pretty effectively by the Iranian regime to gain support for a nuclear program. And the Iranians are some of the only people in the world who even know what a centrifuge is. I mean, it's not normal for people to actually understand what a gas centrifuge is. But the Iranians, because of this nationalism behind the program, tend to.
So what is the state of Iran's nuclear program now?
Iran's program is pretty advanced. I mean, its centrifuge program is capable, if it wanted to do so, start making weapon-grade uranium. It may take a while to get enough for a bomb, but still it could do it. I don't personally think right now they're ready to do it or willing to do it, because it means they're going to be exposed to tremendous international pressure and possible military strikes. So I think in 2010, I don't expect Iran to make a move toward nuclear weapons. 2011, 2012, it could be a different story.
Isn't there a debate now, too, about, like, what do we do? Do we bomb Iran if it builds a nuclear a weapon, or do we practice, containment, try to prevent them from actually using it and hope that, like with China, like with the former Soviet Union, that the weapons will exist but not be used?
Well, there's another way of approaching it, too, which is really more motivated by Libya and South Africa, which is the containment, in a way it's like a mini Cold War, is meant to show a determination to end the program and try to end it before it gets nuclear weapons. If it gets nuclear weapons, try to end it then and get Iran to give up those nuclear weapons. And so it's not a containment to accept it. It's a program to end it. And at the same time, to try to limit the spread of nuclear weapons into the region. And so that's part of the reason to start to work more closely with the Arab states is you don't want Saudi Arabia panicked about Iran and then seek some kind of nuclear umbrella or alliance with Pakistan. You don't want Egypt feeling that, look, we had to tolerate Israel's nuclear arsenal. Now we're supposed to tolerate Iran's. And then they seek their own indigenous capability, probably with smuggling, to develop nuclear weapons themselves. So the containment strategy is to limit the damage Iran does, deter it against using its nuclear capabilities or eventually its weapons, and then try to limit the damage that's done while having a policy that's aimed at getting rid of those Iranian weapons.
How would you compare the Obama and Bush strategies for dealing with Iran's nuclear aims?
Well, I think the Bush administration finally started to think through what it wanted to do. And the last year or two wasn't too bad. But it was, too little too late. Obama came roaring in willing to do all kinds of things. And I think it's, from Iran's point of view, it may be a little too late. And they're so close to having this nuclear weapons capability, feeling that the punishment so far for moving in those directions has been so manageable. It's not been slight, but it's been manageable, that I think they want to go further and try to get as far as they can, and they're not in the mood for negotiations. And I think they still view that the regime views that the going in this direction helps them domestically. And so I think for Obama, you know, it was unfortunately maybe a little late. And so he now has the unpleasant job of ratcheting up the pressure while avoiding war. With Israel in the background, that's never easy.
You make some suggestions in your book about what the international community could do to prevent more countries from becoming nuclear countries. Tell us a couple of those suggestions.
Well, I think in looking at illicit trade, the things that kind of popped out at ISIS
That's your group.
Yes, and I also could see in working with companies is part of the problem is we don't detect this illicit smuggling soon enough. I mean, in a way the CIA was lucky to bust the con network. I mean, it didn't have to happen that way. Israel was lucky to learn about the Syrian reactor before it went online, and then it bombed it. But bombing is not a good option, and so these last lines of defense are just not—they're necessary, but they're not what you want. And so you want first lines of defense, and that really part of that is detecting this activity much quicker. And what I've seen in practice is companies are natural allies in this. They don't want their stuff in these secret programs. And they're pretty sophisticated at spotting these suspicious inquiries for their products. And when they work with governments, it becomes synergistic and the detection comes much earlier. And the intelligence agencies or governments get to see into these networks much quicker and more deeply.
What do you think the odds are that there will be a nuclear attack in some country, on some kind of country in your lifetime?
Well, I think the chance of it is low, but it's not low enough. And if you think of the Chernobyl accident in 1986 that spread radiation all over Europe and Russia, these low probability events can happen. And if it's a nuclear weapon, it's devastating. It can kill tens or hundreds of thousands of people. And so I don't feel very confident that it's not going to happen. And although I see it as low chance it could happen, that's far too high of a chance given the destructiveness of these weapons. And I think we have to do everything we can to try to reduce the number of countries with nuclear weapons, and to actually work toward getting rid of all nuclear weapons. I mean, maybe we'll never reach that, but it's a lot healthier to try to get rid of these things, which I don't think anyone sees as beneficial.
You talked about how the AQ Con network turned down Al-Qaeda when Al-Qaeda wanted nuclear materials from them. What do you think the odds are that Al-Qaeda will actually have a nuclear weapon?
I think Al-Qaeda is going to work very hard to try to get one. And the more countries that get nuclear weapons or are working on nuclear weapons, then Al-Qaeda's chances improve. They need the nuclear explosive material, and they're going to have to get it, and that's not easy. They're also going to have to learn how to make a nuclear weapon, at least a crude one that would work for them. And it would certainly be simpler than the ones nations need. But unfortunately, in a sense, time is on their side.
When I was a kid growing up during the Cold War, I used to have a lot of nuclear war nightmares. We were doing the nuclear drills. We had to hide under your desk and stuff like that.
Okay, I did those too.
Yeah, so since you're in the nuclear nonproliferation business and you're studying this nuclear stuff all the time, you're so immersed in it, do you have nuclear dreams?
Not anymore. I mean, I certainly got into this business out of kind of the horror that I saw that nuclear weapons could do. And at that time, it was between the United States and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't require much to be totally devastating. And so I used to think about it more. I must say, you know, I wouldn't say I've gotten used to it, but I've learned to live with it. And it's really, I think it's important that people work on it, but you've got to accept that you're in a sense staring into, you know, some pretty ugly things when you work on it.
And do you meet a lot of pretty ugly people too? Do you meet any of the proliferators that you write about? Any of the smugglers?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we sometimes in the past have hired them if they're willing to plead guilty. We're willing to hire them as consultants to tell their story, help us understand smuggling better. I've met people in countries like Iraq, South Africa that were involved in their nuclear weapons programs. And, you know, some are creepy. You know, some are very nice people. You know, some you can kind of laugh and make banter about the smuggling or the making of the bomb or the tricking of the supplier. I mean, you know, there's always you can always have human relationships with these people, and many of them are quite nice. But there are some really creepy ones, and that makes this whole thing a little more dangerous, that this isn't just nice people, in a sense, making mistakes. I mean, there's some evil people out there who want people to get nuclear weapons and on the other side want nuclear weapons, and they're not going to hesitate to use them if it was up to them.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
David Albright is the author of Peddling Peril, and he's the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security. You can read a chapter of his book on our website, freshair.npr.org. It was kind of shocking to learn that Alex Chilton died yesterday at the age of 59. He was scheduled to perform this weekend at the South by Southwest Music Conference in Austin. When Chilton was a teenager in the 1960s, his band The Box Tops had the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. In the early 70s, Chilton co-founded the band Big Star. The band sold almost no records, but became an underground legend, as did Chilton. So revered was he by the next generation that the Replacements recorded a song simply called Alex Chilton. Tomorrow we'll listen back to an interview with Chilton. Now we'll listen back to our rock historian Ed Ward's review of a four-disc collection of Big Star recordings, demos, and outtakes that Ed says was one of the most welcome reissues of 2009.
She's a schemer and she makes me mad, but I love her a lot. Those lonely nights I was in a big room playing my thing, so I wish she were here. She can be so kind when she's not trying to hide. She tries not to love me, but she knows she can. And why don't you come?
Big Star was almost named the Sweden Cream. Taking a break from recording at Ardent Studios in Memphis one evening, the four band members, Alex Chilton, Chris Bell, Jody Stevens, and Annie Hummel, were standing outside talking about what to name this group which had suddenly come into being. There were two buildings across the street. One was an ice cream shop, the other a Memphis grocery chain with a big red star as a logo. Bell, Stevens, and Hummel were school friends, and Chris and Jody worked at Ardent at night, learning how to run a recording studio. They were rabid Anglophiles. Chris often told his brother he'd been born in the wrong country at the wrong time and should be leading a band like The Who or The Kinks. Certainly, they wrote some interesting songs, and at one point, John Fry, one of the owners of Ardent, went to New York with a tape they'd made, only to have it turned down as being too derivative of the Beatles. Into this situation came Alex Chilton, who, as a 16-year-old, had tasted major success as the frontman of the Box Tops, whose hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby had given him an education in how to be ripped off by your record company. He'd used Ardent for some Box Top sessions, and now that he was free of his contract, he dropped by to see his old friend Chris Bell. Soon, he was at Ardent at night, too, and writing songs with Chris. They were good. U.S. Big Star songs are a distinctly American take on the kind of pop the British invasion had brought to this country, and far from the sort of southern rock the Allman Brothers and others were doing in 1972, when Big Star's ironically named debut, number one record, was released on the new Ardent Records label. Ardent did recording for Stax when Stax's studios were overbooked, and with Stax being distributed by Columbia, Ardent, as a division of Stax, was assured of blanket distribution. But that's not what happened. A casualty of machinations within Columbia, number one record barely got distributed at all. It got a rave review in Rolling Stone, but a rave review is not much good if you can't buy the album. Chris Bell, who'd been working for years on this band before Alex Chilton came along, was devastated. To make things worse, his longtime girlfriend left him. Words were spoken, fists flew, and by the time it was over, Chris was in a psychiatric institution. Alex and the other two continued making demos, and a couple of years later, in 1974, a second album, Radio City, appeared. It was even better. September Girls would be a hit, but not for Big Star, and not for over a decade, when the Bangles recorded it in a more pop-friendly world. Andy Hummel threw in the towel and went back to school. Meanwhile, Chris Bell was recuperating. Like Chilton, he was from a wealthy family, so it was relatively easy for him to pack up with his brother and head to Europe for an extended trip. He took with him two recordings he'd made, and was honored when Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick mixed one of them for him. But he couldn't get any record companies to bite on I Am the Cosmos or the equally excellent You and Your Sister, even after EMI had reissued the two Big Star albums in England. So he went back to Memphis and took a job with his family's restaurant management company while recruiting a band of young kids to work with him. Coming home from a rehearsal late at night a few days after Christmas 1978, he went off the road at high speed and was killed. Rumors persisted among the growing Big Star underground, though, that there was a third album in the can. Tracks cut in 1974 by Alex and Jody, who was still working at Ardent as an engineer, and overseen by producer Jim Dickinson. There was, in fact, and it was experimental, eccentric, and uncommercial. Just what the fans wanted.
At nighttime I go out and see the people. Echoes cool and hurrying on my way. And dressings are sweet, all the people to see. They're looking at me, all the people to see. And when I set my eyes.
By the time the album, titled either Third or Sister Lovers, depending on which version you bought, came out in 1978 on the tiny PVC label, Big Star was history. Jody continued to work at Ardent, and Alex spent a number of years washing dishes in a New Orleans restaurant. Eventually, however, the band's reputation hit critical mass, and reissues became available. All those kids had bought number one record in Radio City had bands now, and their music was called Power Pop. Chilton emerged, reluctantly, to record some more and produce the Cramps. He still wasn't a big star, but he was a legend.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France and wants to thank Kent Benjamin for his help with the piece. Alex Chilton died yesterday. He was 59. Tomorrow, we'll listen back to an interview with him. I'm Terry Gross.